Raju Narasetty is a journalism and media icon who currently leads global publishing for McKinsey & Company, the globally renowned management consulting firm. At McKinsey, Raju leads an organization responsible for all publishing channels, including its website, video, podcast, newsletters, reports, and the McKinsey Quarterly in print, and more. Raju has led the newsrooms and businesses of some of the largest, best-known organizations in the world. It's a resume that would take too long to read, but includes the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Economic Times, News Corp, Gizmodo, and he's the founder of India's national business newspaper, Mint. Anchored in diversity with a proven global track record at the highest levels, Raju's career has helped some of the oldest brand names rediscover and ethically maintain their digital-centric relevance. As a writer and content marketer who began in hyperlocal journalism, interviewing Raju is a massive honor, an opportunity I don't take lightly. He's truly world-class, and his approachability is inspiring. Waymarker, meet Raju Narasetty.
All right. Welcome, Raju. They would have already heard my formal introduction for this episode, so we've got that out of the way, but I was hoping, if it's okay with you, can we start with like your pre-professional origin story, if you will? Where are you from? What were you into as a kid? Those kinds of things.
Sure, absolutely. You want to? How do you want to do this? You want to ask a question and you want me to respond, or?
I'm kind of just curious to hear kind of how you came, like before work and everything, like where does your story begin? Where are you from? Who is Raju?
Yeah, as you can tell from my name and my accent, I was born and grew up in India. The first 19 years of my life was in a city called Hyderabad, which is in southern India, has about probably now about 12 million people, doesn't even make the top five cities in India. So I grew up there and then spent a few years in New Delhi and Ahmedabad before coming to the US to study for my master's in journalism.
Awesome. And where was your first stop in the US?
So I joined Indiana University in Bloomington to do my master's, and this was 1991, the fall of 91. And then that summer, the following year, was one of 10 summer interns that were selected nationally by the Wall Street Journal. And that was my first exposure in terms of actually participating in US journalism. Went back to school to finish my master's and then worked at a small paper in Ohio called the Dayton Daily News, which was back then the 50th largest newspaper in the US. So spent about 3 years with them.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I told you I'm in Indianapolis now, and my in-laws and my wife kind of all went to IU, so definitely familiar with that community. And then I grew up in like East Central Indiana, and so Dayton was not too far away either. So yeah, familiar with that place as well.
Yeah, very Midwestern.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, awesome. And you talked about how your journalism career began. Another thing I was interested in, Raju, is going from that transition to journalist, or call it like individual contributor, to people leader. So I know you've led, you know, some of the largest newsrooms and businesses in the world. I know Gizmodo, like that brand alone, it has so many iconic brands beneath it. But just at the individual and leader level, how do you think about making that transition? And that's something that I've thought of a lot in my career is, all right, now I'm a people leader and it's kind of a whole different ball game. So can you just kind of talk about that transition as well as your leadership style maybe?
Yeah, in a newsroom environment, which is where I first moved from, making individual contributions to journalism to being an editor, it's a little bit easy in some sense because if you become an editor of a group of reporters, you very vicariously make them do the reporting you'd have done had you done the story yourself, right? So the transition feels a little bit easier in some ways. Sometimes the challenging part tends to be if you miss your own byline, you'd want to kind of over-edit your reporters, and you want to make sure that you're not doing that. But honestly, in my case, I was never a very good writer. I was a pretty good reporter. So to me, writing was a way to get my reporting out of the way so I could do more reporting. So I didn't become one of those editors who rewrote everything because of that. So I think that helped. But where I was good in helping my reporters was to see the gaps and what they're missing, the questions they're not asking, and sharpening that. So it felt like a relatively easy adjustment to being a manager of and a leader of people. And then over time, I was given opportunities that was really at the intersection of journalism and technology and product. And I have an MBA from India. I have a business interest in business. And so as a result, I kind of gravitated towards roles where I became more of a manager of large groups of folks, which means that I was managing managers who were managing reporters. And there, you asked what I think of my style. You know, it evolves over time. You get older, you get wiser in some ways. Sometimes you learn the hard way of like making managerial mistakes. If you were to ask me today, some of the consistent, and people will tell you that perhaps in my leadership would be, I tend to be kind of short-term impatient with day-to-day tasks and long-term patient with results. So I can come across as like being impatient in like getting to the tasks and getting them done, but I tend to have a longer term horizon. So I think once my team adjusts to that, especially when I go to a new role, I tend to be pretty upfront about saying what my expectations are. I'll give you a simple example. I'm a very early morning person. So my teams are used to getting emails from me at like 4:30 a.m., 5 a.m. And I very cautiously tell them, in fact, if you get an email from me at the bottom, it'll say, I'm working in my work hours, so don't feel like you have to respond unless it's your working hours. So there are things like that where you have to go out of your way to make sure, because when you're a manager, you don't want people to second guess you and wonder what I'm thinking. I tend to be fairly straightforward as well, to the point where people sometimes find my lack of like niceties, if you will, you know, hello, please, thank you. But they get used to the idea that, you know, if he says something, that's what he means. There's nothing behind it. So it works both ways.
I love it. I don't know if this is like a made up friction for me, but I wanted to also ask you, just based on your career journey, if you feel like there is this friction between creativity and business results, because if you go from the technical skill set to managing a newsroom to leading a business, like the entire business, how do you approach that as a manager? I guess it's a big communication approach, but I don't know if that makes sense, but I just looking at your career journey is kind of inspiring to me as someone who started in writing in local media, now doing content marketing for a software company, where I have to think about not just the story, but how it impacts the business. I was wondering how you thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, in the news context, actually, it is part of the kind of the structure of a news industry and a news organization, right? There's this notion of church and state, where there's this sense that if you're creating content in the newsroom, that's your primary task, and you're not necessarily engaging in the commercial side of things. I think where the news industry has struggled over the years is what used to be church and state, somewhere along the way morphed into church versus state and created a lot of tension between these two groups, which I believe church and state needs to exist because both have a reason to, you know, be somewhat distinct. But there's very little reason why it is church versus state, because if you don't understand the business you're in, even if though journalism is the product, journalism will suffer, because if the business doesn't work well, then you don't have the resources to do that. So I think there's a lot of like misconceptions about what the other side does. And I think the more people can understand what's happening across the aisle, if you will, with enough safeguards, I think it's actually good for the industry. So I no longer, I don't see inherent tension in this. I see the need to keep them somewhat distinct, but work together. And in my role, I mean, at publishing at McKinsey inherently has a bit of a church and state, in the sense that publishing is not seen as lead generation automatically, right? Meaning that you can still publish great insights and good business ideas, and that will lead to good things for the business side of McKinsey. And you should measure that by all means, but it doesn't have to be very overt. It doesn't have to have like a come hither kind of messaging that sometimes kind of impacts what you're trying to say. So I think that you have to preserve those boundaries, because at the end of the day, you want to put out useful, interesting content. In our case, we like to think of it as the insights to impact journey, because anybody can have insights, but if you can't show somebody how to kind of turn that into impact for themselves, then there's not a much value, right? So that's the way I would think about it. Is there tension? In news organizations, there's always a tension between why are you doing something? So if you're an advertising-based business, oftentimes the tension is, can you keep somebody for as long as possible? Because the longer time they are with you, the more ads you can serve them, right? But there has to be a balance between trying to provide a value exchange rather than clickbait to keep somebody from giving you more time.
The insights to impact point really resonates. I think like we want to educate, and just in my work, we want to educate our audience through these different stories and insights. But it ultimately, it also has to make an impact on the business. And I think those two things, what you said, I think there are about like there are boundaries that need to exist inside of our business. But the outcome is we have a shared outcome at the end of the day. That really resonates the way you put that. I should have asked this earlier, but can you talk about your role at McKinsey and what the purpose of global publishing is at a firm like McKinsey?
Sure. So McKinsey has been in publishing for almost 60 years now. They began with the McKinsey Quarterly, which still exists in print, but also increasingly in a digital format. And the belief of the kind of the at that time leaders of McKinsey was that if you put out good ideas and good knowledge, that'll be good for business. You don't have to make it overt, meaning that if you have really good insights in solving the problems for CEOs and business leaders, if they see that as being useful for them, they will naturally gravitate towards McKinsey in wanting to do that. So McKinsey was the pioneering, the creator, if you will, of what's now called thought leadership. We don't call it that at McKinsey, but that's what it is. And so the team at McKinsey that I have, which is global publishing, focuses on firm level, by that I mean McKinsey level, cross-cutting ideas that are relevant for our readers. And our readers tend to be usually, I would say, general manager and VP all the way to the CEO and the board, people in businesses around the world and in governments and sometimes policymakers and regulators, who mostly are comfortable in English because we publish primarily in English, and who have either challenges or opportunities and are looking for interesting ways to apply insights and scenarios to their own situation. And our hope is that they look at our ideas and our publishing and say, you know, these guys have some interesting ways to solve my problem. Let me reach out to them, right? That's kind of the hope, and that's the, if you will, ROI of why an organization like McKinsey, whose main job is consulting, is also in investing in business publishing.
Gotcha. No, that's perfect. Our audience base is largely folks looking for career guidance, actually. And that was a big reason I reached out to you, aside from my selfish reasons, wanting to ask you questions about publishing, right? So can you describe your first job? Because I know from my research that your very first job maybe wasn't in publishing. And then how did you make that transition into this wonderful journalism career?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, I have an MBA from India, and I actually joined a big consumer products company that was selling cheese and butter and things like that, and did that for about a year and a half. Was fairly good at it, but increasingly felt like I don't want to spend the rest of my life measuring my success in the number of trucks of cheese and butter that I sold. When I kind of stepped back a little bit and did some introspection of what do I like doing, it was mostly around growing up in a household where my dad was an editor of a local newspaper in India. My mom was an English professor, and we grew up with a lot of words and conversations about things. And I realized that that was what kind of was interesting for me. And so I made a switch. I did a 1 year program in journalism in India, and briefly worked for India's largest at that time, a business newspaper called The Economic Times. But felt like I also hadn't studied journalism in a more formal way. I was working for the largest newspaper in India, so I could write and I could report, but I felt like I needed to understand the place of journalism in society and ethics and all of that, and was inspired by a mentor in India who convinced me to apply to a bunch of schools in the US. Did that, and I come from a very lower, middle-class family in India, so couldn't really afford to go to the Columbias of the world. Indiana University offered me the opportunity to potentially come and then end up get some financial aid. And back then, Indiana's Ernie Pyle School of Journalism was still one of the top 10 schools, journalism schools in the US. So ended up there and got a couple of breaks. Like I said, I was picked as one of 10 summer interns when I was still at IU, and that did two things. One, it showed me that I could be a summer intern at the Wall Street Journal. I think I had about 9 or 10 bylines, which may not seem a lot now, but in a 10-week internship, to have 10 articles published in the Wall Street Journal was a pretty big deal back then. This was 1991. And then that led me to a former Wall Street Journal editor was the business editor of the Dayton Daily News, Greg Srihachak, who turned out to be an amazing mentor and taught me a lot that later helped me become successful at the journal. So that was the transition from a ambition to be a journalist to be a journalist.
I love that. I know I'm mentoring a few people who are interested in either journalism specifically or content marketing or somewhere in between. What advice would you give a young person or anyone really who's interested in making the switch to, let's say, journalism in 2023 or beyond?
Yeah, so two ways to think about it, right? One really macro way to think about it is, even today, there are 2 billion people on our planet out of give or take 8 billion people who don't use the internet every day or regularly for various reasons, who are all going to be using the internet, all of that in a regular way over the next 5-10 years. And a lot of them will be looking for content, right, including news. So the demand for news has a long, long way to go before it is anywhere close to being saturated, right? Huge appetite for it. And then when you really think about it, Meta, Facebook, Snap, Twitter, YouTube, ChatGPT, you name it, none of them are actually creators of original content. They're all amazing platforms for virality, dissemination, sharing, and amplification. So the actual job of creating content is still done by humans and still done mostly by newsrooms around the world. So the fundamental demand for what you can produce as a journalist is not only there, it's going to be there for a very, very, very long time. So in that sense, your skills are going to be valuable. I think the way, if I were going into journalism now, is to say, I'm a good storyteller. I can, assuming that's your strength, right? And I can tell, the skills I need are to tell stories where the audience is going to be and in what format they're going to consume. Well, it could be video, audio, words, pictures, you name it. And that's the skill I need to learn if I go get a journalism degree. And combine that with the one thing that you have to be a successful journalist, which is curiosity. Because that underlines everything you can do, because the best journalists are always kind of asking why, and they see, hear something, and then exploring that, and then telling that story to a larger audience. Right? So if you think of yourself that way, and that you're picking up all those multimedia skills by investing in a degree, I don't think you have to have a journalism degree, but those kind of skills, then you have a very bright future. Because if you combine those skills, saying that I will tell stories where the audience is going to be, then you're not worried about being a newspaper reporter or a radio or a TV person. You are kind of saying, I can tell amazing stories. I know the multimedia way to do it. And I can be wherever my audience is going to be, because who knows where they will be 10 years from now, right? They may not be on TikTok. And then if you combine that with like my larger point about a couple of billion people still looking for this, I think people interested in this line of work have a very bright future.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah, the numbers seem high now just because of the scale of these platforms, these different media platforms are at. But there's also parts of the world that are just now emerging online, if you will, and growing really quickly, which is exciting. I think your comments make me think of that for sure. So speaking of brands, I wanted to ask you, if it's okay, what are some of your favorite brands, if that's something that you can answer? And I'm interested why, just from your experience and your skill sets, what those would be.
Happy to. I mean, obviously, I have to say, and I believe it, otherwise I wouldn't be in this job for this long. If you're looking for B2B publishing, right, I would say McKinsey Publishing, right? I think we are really good. And on any given day, I would love to compare myself to pretty much anybody out there in that space. And I think we are better. Sure, others sometimes do good stories that make me envious. But as a body of work, I think we do a really great job. And our numbers and our audience and our size reflects that. When it comes to news, I am, I guess, a bit of a traditionalist in that way. I still read newspapers. I get the New York Times, my hometown paper, which I really like, and I've been a fan of for a long, long time. They're also, I think, a very smart company, let alone the journalism. I still read the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and The Economist. So I grew up with these brands, and I still like them. I tend to be an equal opportunity offender in the sense that I can find the good and bad, perhaps putting on my editor hat now that I'm not an editor at these places, and be able to see that like this story had some gaps and I wish they asked these questions. So in that sense, and I'm increasingly finding that a lot of my consumption these days tends to be newsletters in the morning, curated ones, a range of things in media and elsewhere. And then I spend some time, I still get a couple of newspapers at home, I do that. And then throughout the day, I'm dipping in and out, depending on what it is. But I mean, if you ask me brands more broadly, I consume a fair amount of Netflix, right? So, and I like, I know, you know, it's gone through its ups and downs, but I like them. I do a lot of, if I look at my devices, they're all Apple, and also that way, I think I'm fairly a big brands kind of a guy.
Yeah, for sure. I'm also a consumer of McKinsey, Netflix, and Apple. So, yeah, proud subscriber. So,
the good news is, unlike those two, we are free.
Yeah, exactly. It is. You can sign up to as many newsletters as you want on McKinsey. So,
yeah, we have. We actually have about 45 different ones by subject and by topic. Our website is free, and then the other good thing is like most people don't realize that we have a lot of first-party data, meaning that we have a 30,000 survey panel. So we actually get a lot of data that is not available. And all of that is available at McKinsey.com. You can download it for free. We don't really ask for anything. Sure, if you're downloading, we may say, what's your email? That's driven less by, again, we have no ads. We're not trying to sell you anything. That's driven by our desire to kind of personalize things. And if I get to know you a little better, we publish a lot. So I would rather you not feel overwhelmed or have to go find things. And if I know a little bit about you, you know, your email, which company you work or where you are, I might be able to offer you more personalized stuff and save you time. Look, I think the end of the day, the way I think about my role is, I'm not in news. I'm not in trying to make money off individual readers by selling ads against them. But end of the day, I am no different than what I was at the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or anywhere else, which is the one single thing we are all competing for is really, Jimmy, the single non-renewable resource our audiences have, and I'll repeat that, the single non-renewable resources our audiences have is their time. So in a way, we are all competing for that time. And my view is that if I can get 10 more minutes of your time, what I do with that is on me, right? By providing you engaging experiences, by giving you reasons to come back to me. But if I don't have that, if I lose you to anybody, right? The Economist, New York Times, BCG, Bain, you name it, then I don't even have the opportunity. So all I'm trying to say is that I'm not worried about defining myself as B2B. I'm saying if Jimmy is reading 10 things in a day, I would love to be part of that, and I would love to have a disproportionate time of that, right? So when the Wall Street Journal publishes an amazing article and it's you take a half hour from that, that's half hour I don't have, right? So I need to also worry about like how are they presenting, how are they packaging. So we have this belief that great insights are important, and but also table stakes. The experience layer on top of the content layer in kind of consuming McKinsey anything should be interesting and engaging. So if you're given a choice and you want to read something about sustainable inclusive growth, everybody is publishing about that, right? It's not like we are the only ones publishing. But my hope is that A, you'll find our information more valuable, but you'll only know that if you spend time with me. But what I'm trying to do is to create an interesting experience for you in consuming that knowledge. So the next time you're like, I need to go find something, you're like, you know, let me go to McKinsey, because the last time I was there it was useful and interesting and engaging, right? So that's what I'm trying to do here. In that way, I'm doing exactly what I would do as a publisher at Gizmodo Media Group or anywhere else I've been before.
Hmm. You're very empathetic, I think. I'm sure as a human, but yeah, as a publishing leader, there's a lot of empathy in that and the audience experience. So yeah, I definitely feel that.
We have to take our audiences seriously, right? Because especially in the digital world, they're very promiscuous because they can be. And I'm like totally fine if you want to go sample the wares, but I would rather you start with me every day. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm aiming for, right? I'm not trying to stop anybody from going anywhere else. In fact, a lot of our curated newsletters tend to point to other things, not just McKinsey, because I'm like trying to help you navigate the sea of information by saying I'm a trusted source. So I will help you do that. And in doing so, I'll definitely point out a bunch of things that McKinsey is doing. But then I hope that you will say, you know what, I have only 5 minutes. Let me start with McKinsey because they are helpful in this regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes a ton of sense. As we get toward the end, I want to respect, I told you that we would keep this at a certain time. The last thing I always ask people when they come on is, what is the kindest thing someone's done for you at work or just work related as you, think about your entire career journey, if anything stands out?
So I'm horrible at like asking for favors and actually receiving favors. By nature, I'm terrible at it. People tell me just take the compliment when somebody says something nice to me. So I'm not sure it's kind, but there are a couple of people without whom I probably wouldn't have had this career in the US. Actually make that three, because a professor of mine, as I mentioned, Thomas Uman, was the one who pushed me very hard to say, you need to go study journalism, and I would rather you go to the US and do that. That's one. Two, Carol Heimowitz, who was the, at that time, the bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal in Pittsburgh, who not only offered me an internship, and later, a few years later, called me one day and said, I've been tracking your work and we have an opening. Would you like to come work for us? And then in between that, as I said, Greg Strihachuk, the business editor at the Dayton Daily News. But for all three of them, I don't think I would have come to the US and then made my life here and made my career here. So they were instrumental in hiring me as an intern, giving me jobs, teaching me everything I know. So I'm eternally grateful for all three of them.
Amazing. Well, we're very grateful for you for joining the Waymarker podcast. It's not lost on me, how valuable your time. You talked about your audience's time, but I know your time is very valuable, and McKinsey is a very big operation. That'd be a massive understatement. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Jimmy.
All right. See you, Jim.